extraordinary. First came Jackie Kennedy, walking between Robert and Edward, her face veiled in black, but her shoulders back, behind them a group of other Kennedys, then the Johnsons. He had been advised not to walk but to go to the cathedral inside a car but had refused, and around him the heads of Secret Service agents swiveled back and forth as they scanned the roofs along the route and the windows. And after them came what the Times called an assembly of the world's leaders such as this city has never seen. In the first row behind the Johnsons were a king, Baudouin of Belgium, a queen, Frederica of Greece, a prince, Philip of England, three presidents, Lübke of West Germany, Macapagal of the Philippines, and General Park Chung-hee of South Korea. And two figures who, each in his own way, stood out even in this assemblage. One, quite tall, de Gaulle of France, erect and dignified in a soldier's plain khaki uniform, not a decoration on it. The other, quite short, the Lion of Judah, Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia, all but aglow with medals and braid. And behind this group came a throng of other heads of state and world leaders, more than 100 of them. And after the service, there was another moment. 3-year-old John F. Kennedy, Jr. was standing next to his mother on the sidewalk outside the cathedral as John F. Kennedy's coffin was lifted onto the caisson for the last time, and the horses began to pull it away to lead the procession to Arlington. As his father's body passed, the little boy in his blue coat drew himself up to attention and, standing stiff as a soldier, raised his hand to his forehead in a salute. At Arlington, with the troops drawn up below the gravesite, massed soldiers among the graves of soldiers fallen, fighter jets screamed overhead with, as was military custom, one plane missing from the formation, and then Air Force One flew over, very low, and Colonel Swindle dipped its wings in farewell, and then there was the rifle salute and taps, and the lighting of the eternal flame, and as the last of the dignitaries left, the crowds began to trudge up the hill. Never in American history, never in the history of any republic since perhaps the great pageants of Rome, had the passage of power been marked by such pageantry, pageantry which made the 3 days of funeral ceremonies for John F. Kennedy three of the most memorable days in American history. The images of those days, of the coffin on the gun carriage, of the widow in her veil, erect and tearless in grief, tearless in public, inside the cathedral she broke down once, crying and shaking uncontrollably. Of her children, Caroline and John John, the little girl's hand creeping under the flag and the little boy's hand up in salute. Of the long processions, of 100 heads of state walking behind the caisson. Of blackjack and the matched grays, of Air Force One dipping its wings over Arlington, were poignant, dramatic, indelible. And they were engraved indelibly on the consciousness of the nation, and, to a remarkable extent, of the world, in a way that had never before happened with a major historical event, because these images were seen live as they were happening, which added to the drama, to the viewer's sense of involvement, and to the viewer's emotions. The juxtaposition of tapes of the happy Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy touring at her husband's side in the Texas morning, with the live pickup of her arrival behind her husband's coffin in the Washington Evening, were almost too much to bear, Jack Gould wrote. Television had given a new dimension to grief, he said. People didn't have to be satisfied with a description of the great parades. They saw the parades for themselves. And it wasn't only funeral ceremonies that were seen live. "He's been shot! He's been shot! Lee Harvey Oswald has been shot! Pandemonium has broken out," an NBC announcer shouted, and then viewers saw police officers swarming over a balding man with a gun. Oswald's mortal wounding and Jack Ruby's arrest marked, as the Times said, the first time that a real-life homicide had occurred in front of live cameras. It wasn't grief alone that during those 3 days had been given a new dimension. "For total horror," Gould wrote, "nothing could quite compare with Oswald's death on live TV. Through television, the shock of history reverberated in every home," Gould wrote. Clustered around millions of television screens, most Americans were involved in the death and burial of Kennedy to a degree unimaginable before the age of electronic communications, wrote Lewis Herron, then chief Washington correspondent of the London Times. The grief and pride of those days became a collective national experience surely unprecedented anywhere in the world and any time in history. And, Herron says, because of television, Americans were involved to a similar extent not only in Kennedy's death, but in his life. During those 3 days, he says, thousands of feet of film were shown, of Kennedy on the campaign trail, at home, as president, and even speaking in Texas a few hours before he was killed. No man, living or dead, had ever been given such concentrated exposure. Television, the medium Jack Kennedy had understood before other politicians understood it. Do you know who's the most well-known senator in the United States? The medium that had done so much to make him his party's nominee, and then had done so much to make him president, had now, during those 3 days, transmuted him into a figure of legend and myth. During those 3 days, the focus of America and the world was on Washington, but on the White House and the Capitol and the Cathedral and the cemetery. Very little was on the executive office building. On Sunday and Monday, Lyndon Johnson's relegation to the background, to the sidelines of the events unfolding in Washington that had begun on Saturday, continued. The television cameras across Pennsylvania Avenue could have panned slightly and shown the side entrance of the EOB as well as the North Portico. But there was no Marine Honor Guard at the EOB, no long line of limousines pulling up to it, no long line of the mighty of the land going in, just the very occasional car with a cabinet member, Rusk or McNamara, getting out quickly and hurrying through the door. There were no television cameras inside EOB 274, and what would they have shown had they been there? Just Johnson talking on the telephone, or sitting at the conference table talking to Rusk or McNamara. Indeed, each time a conference was finished, the photographers, still photographers, were called in, and the pictures were taken, and newspapers ran them. Obviously posed pictures, static, dull. And indeed, the setting in which Lyndon Johnson was working hardly seemed one in which memorable events would occur, particularly in contrast with the majestic settings, the East Room, the Rotunda, in which the vivid pageantry of those days was being played out. It hardly seemed presidential, just a governmental office suite, a little more elegantly decorated than most, that, with all the new staff members working in it, was overcrowded, cluttered. Johnson himself was to remember these days in terms of a contrast, of what he called a strange counterpoint between the harsh glare of the fluorescent office lights burning deep into the night, then the somber hush and the dim soft light in the East Room from the four large candles flanking John F. Kennedy's coffin, between the frenzied pace of meetings and briefings held behind closed doors and the measured cadence of the funeral march. At least on Sunday, some of the banner headlines had been about Johnson. Not so on Monday. Most of Monday's banners didn't even mention Lyndon Johnson. President's assassin shot to death in jail corridor by Dallas citizen. Grieving throngs view Kennedy, were the headlines across the top of the front page of the New York Times, for example. None of the stories at the top of that front page were about him. The two huge pictures on the page were of Caroline putting her hand under the flag, and of Oswald grimacing as Ruby shot him, the detective next to Oswald aghast, his mouth open in shock. The Washington Post's photos were of the grimace and the grays as the horses pulled the caisson away from the White House. Johnson barely made the front page of that paper at all. The only story on the activities of the new president was squeezed onto the bottom of the page. Television reported on his activities, but television was the realm of the picture, and what picture could compare with the tape of Oswald's shooting, which was shown over and over that day, or with the live coverage of the incredible procession and the funeral and the foreign leaders following the coffin and the Kennedys? The drama of the 3 days following Jack Kennedy's assassination centered on the flag-draped catafalque in the East Room. Hugh Seide was to write. Beyond the legend of the dead Kennedy, which was then being magnified in every hamlet, was the presence of the Kennedy family. Johnson could not compete with them. The great and the near great came in waves for 3 days. Charles de Gaulle was a more imposing and fascinating figure than the new president. Then there were Selassie, Macapagal, Germany's Ludwig Erhard, Queen Frederica, Ireland's marvelous old De Valera, Mikoyan. Lyndon Johnson had less glamour than any of them. During those 3 days, he stayed in his old office, only on the edge of the drama. He would stay in his own home, too. Asked by reporters when the Johnsons would be moving into the executive mansion at the White House, Lady Bird replied, "I would to God I could serve Mrs. Kennedy's comfort. I can at least serve her convenience." Jacqueline and her children would move out on December 6th. The Johnsons would move in the following day. And although the address of the Elms was being printed in the newspapers, and television was showing pictures of the house during those 3 days, the number of persons standing outside remained surprisingly small. The President of the United States was living there, and during those 3 days, the world didn't seem particularly interested. But for anyone who cared about the art of governing, about political power, about the art of assuming and employing power in a sudden unexpected crisis, about governing a nation, soothing its fears, restoring its confidence, keeping it on course and moving in such a crisis, about governing with hardly a moment for preparation, for anyone who cared about that, what was happening in EOB 274 during those 3 days was memorable too. Part 5. To Become a President. Chapter 16. EOB 274. Some of the items on the list Valenti had scribbled in Lyndon Johnson's bedroom were ceremonial, symbolic, to demonstrate appropriate respect on the part of the new president, respect for God. Infrequent though his visits to church had been, one should be made on Saturday. Respect for his living predecessors, not merely to telephone but to meet face to face with the two, Truman and Eisenhower, physically able to come to Washington, and to elicit from Eisenhower, still the most popular Republican in the country, an expression of support to foster the picture of unity he wanted to paint. Some were to demonstrate sympathy. "Call widow of Officer Tippett," Valenti's list said. And of course there would have to be ceremonial calls on another widow as well. Some to demonstrate continuity and to get briefings on the international situation, by conferring with and being photographed conferring with prominent members of the late president's cabinet, in particular Rusk and McNamara. Some items were both symbolic and substantive, a foreign affairs briefing in the White House Situation Room. These items were quickly arranged and easily scripted. There wasn't much time on Saturday for church, but the most convenient house of worship, St. John's Episcopal Church, right across Lafayette Square, was also the most appropriate. It was called the Church of Presidents because many of them had worshipped there. After a visit to St. John's pastor to request a special memorial service for John F. Kennedy that the new president would attend, the Secret Service assured Juanita Roberts, as she put it in a memo to Johnson, that services will be simple and will last approximately 10 minutes. Since Johnson's attendance mustn't appear to be a bid for publicity, but rather a simple expression of sorrow and faith, presidential panoply would be kept to a minimum, her memo assured him. While there would be a full complement of Secret Service agents inside the church, only one will be on the street in front at time of arrival. He will meet the president and Mrs. Johnson, take them into the church. Reverend Harper will lead the president and Mrs. Johnson down the aisle to second row. Turn left for sitting in the center. Bill Lloyd, one of Johnson's aides, had drafted talking points for the call to Marie Tippett, widow of the Dallas police officer Oswald had killed, and Valenti had redrafted them. "Mrs. Tippett, I know that words are not very useful when your grief runs so deep, but Mrs. Johnson and I wanted you to know that you and your children, Alan, Brenda Kay, and Curtis Ray, are in our thoughts and prayers." Colonel Roberts put a slip in front of him. "Mrs. Tippett is at the funeral home now, arranging for the funeral. She will be home after 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time." In his call, Johnson made the words more personal. "I just want to say God bless you, and I know you're a brave and a great lady," he concluded. "I certainly appreciate your praise of him. It's quite a consolation," Marie Tippett replied. Could I get your address there? Johnson said. I want to drop you a little note, too. And he scrawled an outline for Valenti to flesh out. Johnson began to move down the list with the briefings on the international situation, and here, in a tour d'horizon from Bundy and CIA Director John A. McCone in the Situation Room, the news was good, with no sign that any foreign country was attempting to exploit the assassination. No troubling movement anywhere, not in Cuba, not in Vietnam. It was, Johnson was to say later, almost as if the world had provided a breathing space within which I could concentrate on domestic affairs. McCone explained the president's checklist, with which, he noted in a confidential memo for CIA files, Johnson was not familiar. The summary of international developments prepared by the CIA each morning for the president's information. To Johnson's request that he stay on as director, he simply replied he would do so, as did the next person Johnson conferred with, Secretary of State Rusk. While he was talking to Rusk in 274's conference room, however, Colonel Roberts came in and handed him a note. J. Edgar Hoover is calling on the White House line, and throughout that day he would be interrupted by a torrent of calls from Hoover and McCone about new developments in the FBI and CIA investigations of Oswald, that in the past few weeks the assassin had visited the Soviet embassy in Mexico City, for example. And all that day, Saturday, November 23rd, and during the next 2 days, there would be other new developments for which no script had been prepared, but about which decisions had to be made. It had been expected, of course, that some world leaders would attend the funeral, but Bundy, repeatedly ducking in and out of EOB 274 those 3 days, kept adding names to the list, until it was obvious that leaders would be arriving in Washington in unprecedented numbers. One after another was notifying the State Department that he was coming. There will be de Gaulle, Earhart, Douglas Hume, separate category, Mikoyan, Bundy said in one call, British Foreign Secretary Alec Douglas Hume, and Soviet Deputy Premier Anastas Mikoyan. Scores were coming. Johnson would not be able to meet with all of them individually after the funeral, but did he want to meet with some of them, and if so, which ones? It was important not to offend any. I need your personal guidance on it. It's going to be awfully difficult to pick and choose here, but I think, in fact, to have them come and go and not meet with you will be equally foolish. And if he met with them, what exactly should he say to each one, in meetings in which every word counted? This was dangerous ground. These meetings would be foreign leaders' first impression of Lyndon Johnson, and first impressions could influence the policy of nations. Look at what had happened after Khrushchev in Vienna had met Kennedy for the first time. Need to do, Johnson scribbled on a notepad in front of him. De Gaulle, Hume, Mikoyan. Then there was Congress, the stalemate of the administration's legislative program on many fronts, including civil rights and the intertwined budget and tax cut proposals that had been held up month after month in Harry Byrd's Senate Finance Committee. Because of his exclusion from Kennedy's legislative efforts, he didn't know what he needed to know about the status of those proposals. Much of what he knew, not only about the tax cut and civil rights stalemates, but about the reasons behind the seeming paralysis on other fronts as well, he knew only because, as he had told Sorensen in June, he had got it from the New York Times. But it was his administration now, his legislative program. He was going to be held responsible for its success or failure. He had to find out what the situation was on Capitol Hill. To find out, he turned not to the Senate leader, Mike Mansfield, because he felt that would be no help, but to a senator who knew how to count. Johnson had, in fact, turned to the suave Floridian George Smathers for help in counting before, during his time as majority leader, appointing him his whip or assistant leader. The independent Smathers later refused Johnson's request that he stay in the job, telling him flatly, "I don't want to be your assistant." Johnson had flown into a rage. "What are you saying?" he demanded. To Smathers, it was just as though you had unleashed an awful smell. His nostrils flared. His eyes sort of looked funny. Since Smathers's counting ability and unapologetic pragmatism made him too keen-edged a tool to be discarded, however, Johnson had found another use for him, raiser and dispenser of campaign funds as chairman of the Senate Democratic Campaign Committee, until the end of his time as leader. And now, 3 years later, needing him again, he telephoned him at 2:10 on Saturday afternoon. The purpose of the call was to obtain information, and you don't learn anything when you're talking. So from Johnson, there wasn't any talking. For 10 minutes after Smathers began explaining the tax cut bill's status, the only sounds Johnson made were non-committal little grunts. And by the time Smathers finished, Johnson had learned that the situation was worse, far worse, than Marquis Childs or James Reston realized. For one thing, he had learned that Byrd's opposition to the tax bill was linked to his feelings about the budget Kennedy was to submit to Congress in January. Smathers, a member of Byrd's Finance Committee, said that on Kennedy's behalf he had gone to Byrd and learned that what he was really trying to accomplish was to hold up the tax bill until he could see and prove that Kennedy's budget would be over $100 billion. In other words, that if it was above that figure, he wouldn't approve the tax cuts. Then Smathers had tried to broker a deal with Byrd under which the president would tell him now what he thought his budget would be. Treasury Secretary Dillon thought that getting it down to a figure not too far above $100 billion would satisfy Byrd. Current expectations were for $101.5 billion to $102 billion, Dillon was to tell Johnson. And apparently Kennedy did too. And in return, Byrd would speed up the committee's hearings. According to Evans and Novak, who had evidently been allowed to read a report Heller had prepared on the subject, Kennedy had set an arbitrary budget ceiling of $101.5 billion. Although even after he did so in internal memos, the figure of $102 billion kept cropping up. But that proposal had foundered because, Smathers said, he, Byrd, really doesn't want it, you know. He's really against the tax bill. Then, Smathers said, he had, also on Kennedy's behalf, tried to go around Harry Byrd in the committee. But going around a committee chairman was something very seldom done in the Senate, and never to Harry Byrd. Although two Democratic members of the committee had pledged their votes to Smathers on the going around maneuver, after each had been summoned to a face-to-face meeting with old Harry, each had withdrawn the pledge. Smathers had done some counting of some of the 17 committee members to ascertain how many votes the administration proposals would have in a showdown with Byrd. Not enough. At the last legislative breakfast, which Johnson, in Europe at the time, had not attended, the possibility of getting the tax bill to the floor had been raised, but Mansfield hadn't been much help. He didn't know how many votes we got. I don't know if the leadership isn't in the dark. And in the crunch, neither was the president. Kennedy was there. He wasn't pushing it too hard, Smathers said. Johnson asked whether there was any possibility that Byrd would agree to deal with the proposed amendments to the bill in a reasonable time and pass it this year, before Congress adjourned for the Christmas vacation and the end of its 1963 session. I don't think Byrd will make that kind of an agreement, Smathers replied. He told Johnson that in his opinion there was nothing that could be done about getting the tax reduction bill passed before Christmas. He himself, he said, evidently forgetting Dallas for a moment, but then catching himself in mid-phrase, would do anything short of, you know, anything to try to get it passed. But, he said, passing the bill before Congress adjourned would be simply impossible. There was so much strong feeling against the Kennedy measures, not only in the committee but in Congress as a whole, that Johnson should just abandon the fight. Perhaps the smart thing to do would be for you to get the appropriations bills through real quick and then just adjourn for the year. Johnson told Smathers why he couldn't do that, or at least one of the reasons why he couldn't do that. No, no, he said, I can't do that. That would destroy the Democratic Party and destroy the election, destroy everything. We've got to carry on. We can't abandon this fellow's, Kennedy's, program because he's a national hero, and these people, the Kennedy cabinet and aides, want his program passed, and we've got to keep the Kennedy aura around us through this election. But when he himself, during the same call, got down to another count of the days remaining before adjournment, he learned how hard passing the tax bill, much less the rest of Kennedy's program, was going to be. "Where are your holidays? What are you planning for Thanksgiving?" he asked, and Smathers replied that because of the imminent holiday, the Senate wouldn't be doing much work that week. "Burr doesn't plan any hearings. He couldn't get a quorum, he told me." And Smathers said, "That puts us into December and the Christmas recess." "I tell you, Mr. President, I'd hate to see you make that, the tax bill, a big issue, because I'm afraid we're not going to be able to do it." Discouraging as was the news on the tax bill, that same day, his first full day as president, he also got the news on the budget that was tied in with it. It came in an urgent memo on that budget, the so-called 1965 budget that covered the fiscal year between July 1, 1964 and June 30, 1965, from Budget Bureau Director Kermit Gordon. "We stand at a critical stage in the 1965 budget process," Gordon wrote. "Every agency has submitted its budget requests, and we are now about halfway through our intensive review of these submissions," after which Kennedy's economic team had been scheduled to meet with the president to present our recommendations and explain the conflicts between these recommendations and the higher amounts requested by individual departments and agencies so that he could resolve them. The budget determined many government actions and policies. "Despite the fact that the time is late, I know that you will want to make this budget your budget," Gordon wrote. "Accordingly, I hope we can sit down with you very soon." And the memo closed with a list of dates, the time schedule against which we must work, that showed what "very soon" meant. As it happens, Gordon had the date at the top of the list incorrect. His memo said that January 19th was the date by which, under law, the budget must be submitted to Congress. The correct date was January 20th. January 20th was almost 2 months off, but that was the end date on the list. The line underneath it said, "January 9th, budget message locked up." By that date, all decisions on the message, on the final budget that would be submitted to Congress on January 19th, had to be finalized because it would take 8 days for the final figures for expenditures to be calculated and totaled and measured against tax revenues. And for the message, the huge 439-page document, to be prepared and printed. And underneath January 9th were other dates. December 26th, final day for decisions on proposed legislation. On the bills, complicated bills that had to be drafted with care that would authorize the creation of new federal programs that the president wanted funded in the budget. But before this legislation could be drafted, before any legislation for programs, either new or existing, could be drafted, decisions would have to be made on the individual requests from the departments and agencies, whether to approve or reduce them, which programs to continue or reduce or eliminate. Those decisions had to be made by the president, had to be made by him, after meetings in which, as Gordon's memo said, "we present the major policy issues involved in the budget and obtain your guidance on how we should proceed." 3 weeks had been allowed for such meetings, so the final dates in the memo were December 2nd to 20th, final decisions on agency programs under existing legislation. Defense and space decisions must be virtually complete by December 10th. December 2nd was a week from Monday, the day of Kennedy's funeral. But Gordon's memo said "very soon" meant even sooner than that. The economic team's crucial meetings with President Kennedy to present our recommendations and obtain his decisions had actually been scheduled to begin next Wednesday, a day 4 days off. At 7:40 Saturday evening, another member of the economic team, Walter W. Heller, chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisers, was shown into 274's inner office, and while underlining to Johnson Gordon's urgency, "I told him, Johnson, we were pretty deeply in the process already and that sometime in December or early January he would have to make final decisions," Heller was to recall. He added an additional point, that Kennedy had received budget briefings and a coordinated budget revenue and economic picture from the economic team on a regular basis, so that he had been familiar with many of the considerations that would be involved in making the impending budgetary decisions. Johnson had never received any such briefing. And tight as the time schedule was, it wasn't the hardest problem confronting Johnson on the budget. The document, with its setting of governmental priorities, was a key battlefield in the war between liberals and conservatives. Liberals wanted a larger role for government, wanted bigger and new governmental social welfare programs, and therefore a larger budget. They believed the $11 billion tax cut would, by putting more money into people's pockets, stimulate the economy and thereby increase tax revenues, and the money the government would have available for these programs. Conservatives, uneasy about an expansion in government's role and about the proposed new programs, were opposed to the deficits that would be produced by the higher spending and believed the deficits would be increased by the tax cuts. So Johnson, in starting to deal with the budget, would immediately find himself plunged into the middle of the intense ideological warfare between conservatives and liberals. That very Saturday began a battle to influence the new president's thinking on the budget tax cut issue. A battle, one observer said, for his mind. The militant conservative and former Treasury Secretary Robert Anderson, whom Eisenhower had urged him to see, was Ike's crack general on financial issues, and in a long telephone conversation somehow crammed into Johnson's schedule that Saturday, Anderson told him that the surest way to restore confidence was to cut the budget and reduce the deficit. The cabinet's most aggressive liberals, Udall, Wirtz, and Freeman, had all urged Johnson in the opposite direction. Freeman, in a note which, mindful of what he knew about Johnson, he was careful to keep on one page. Anyone who thought Johnson's mind could be captured didn't know it. He knew what his most important priority was. Leaving 274 that evening, Heller had opened the door, only to find it shut again by Johnson's big hand. Drawing him back into the room, Johnson said, "Now I want to say something about all this talk that I'm a conservative who is likely to go back to the Eisenhower ways or give in to the economy bloc in Congress. It's not so. And I want you to tell your friends, Arthur Schlesinger, Galbraith, and other liberals, that it is not so. I'm no budget slasher. If you looked at my record, you would know that I'm a Roosevelt New Dealer. As a matter of fact, to tell the truth, John F. Kennedy was a little too conservative to suit my taste." But the liberals didn't have the votes in Congress, didn't have the 9 votes necessary to get the tax cut bill out of the 17-member Senate Finance Committee. The economy bloc had the votes, and they had Harry Byrd. Smathers had summed up the prospects for passing the tax cut bill. "We're not going to be able to do it." The problems with Congress that he was aware of, not only the intertwined tax cut and budget bills and the 11 unpassed appropriations bills that were also tied in with them, but civil rights, foreign aid, and school construction, were difficult enough, particularly because the deadlines for solving them were so close. But on Saturday, talking with Mansfield and Humphrey, he was suddenly made aware of another problem on Capitol Hill, one on which, to his surprise, the deadline was much closer. As part of his attempt to ease tensions with the Soviet Union, President Kennedy had, in October, offered to help alleviate its serious food shortage by selling it wheat from America's surplus and by allowing Russia, short of foreign exchange reserves, to finance the purchase on credit from the United States Export-Import Bank. Helping Russia out of a jam was anathema to Capitol Hill hardliners. Calling Kennedy's plan indefensible, one of the hardest, Republican Senator Carl E. Mundt of South Dakota, had attached an amendment to the foreign aid bill prohibiting the Export-Import Bank from extending the credit. The amendment would probably kill the wheat deal. It would certainly infringe on the president's authority in foreign affairs. On November 14th, a week before the president left for Texas, the Kennedy administration had tried to defeat Mundt's prohibition in the Senate, and had failed, mustering only 40 votes. Mundt was then persuaded to withdraw it so that the foreign aid bill could proceed, not that it did proceed, but only by Mansfield's promise that he would be allowed to submit it as a separate bill and to have a vote on it on an early date, which had been set for Tuesday, November 26th. At the legislative leaders' breakfast on November 21st, the day Kennedy left for Texas, Kennedy had insisted that the Mundt bill must be defeated. From the report Mansfield and Humphrey now gave Johnson, however, the former president's words had little relation to reality. The bill, they reported, was probably going to be passed. In reporting this to Johnson, Mansfield and Humphrey seemed to feel that they were talking only about a vote on a wheat sale. And Smathers hadn't considered the Mundt bill important enough to mention it, but none of these senators were Lyndon Johnson, who as master of the Senate had demonstrated a gift, an intuition for seeing in a vote on some individual bill larger implications seen by no one else. In the instant the wheat sale vote was mentioned to him, just the moment he heard about it, George Reedy says, he knew that because of Kennedy's death and the resultant change in presidents, the vote was now about more than the wheat sale, that it now possessed a far broader significance. In confrontations with the former president during the past 3 years, Congress, and in particular the Senate, had won so often, had blocked so many Kennedy legislative proposals, the Congress now felt that in such confrontations, power rested on Capitol Hill, not in the White House. And the confidence among congressmen that they could win battles with the president had made them more willing to fight them, had emboldened them to contest the Kennedy program. "They've got the bit in their teeth," Johnson was to explain to his aides. That was under the former president. A vote on the Mundt bill on November 26th, the day after Kennedy's funeral, would make that measure the first bill to be considered by Congress under the new president. The wheat sale vote was going to be Congress's first confrontation with the Johnson administration, and therefore, its result would be an indication of whether, under the new administration, the situation would remain the same, or if power would shift. The result, Johnson saw in an instant, would be crucial. The feeling on Capitol Hill had to be changed. If Congress won, its confidence that it could still defeat the president would make subsequent battles, over civil rights, for example, or the tax cut, much more difficult for him. "We could not afford to lose a vote like that after only 4 days in office," he was to explain in his memoirs. "If those legislators had tasted blood then, they would have run over us like a steamroller on future votes, when much more than foreign aid would depend on their actions." The Mundt bill had to be defeated. The issue, as a journalist was later to report after Johnson's aides had explained it to him, was simply whether presidential dominion over Congress would be reasserted or not. Since Johnson, at his ranch in Texas preparing for Kennedy's visit, had missed the last leadership breakfast, he hadn't been aware of the bill's status. Learning it from Mansfield and Humphrey sometime on Saturday, he tried to rescue the situation, but when he gave the two leaders the instructions that to him were so elementary, not to schedule the vote on the bill until they were certain they had the votes to defeat it, he was informed that the vote had already been scheduled for Tuesday, and when he told them to delay it, there was a perfectly good excuse for a brief delay, he said, the president's assassination and the resultant need for a new administration to get its bearings. The answer from Mansfield was that he wasn't willing to do that. He had promised Mundt the vote would be on Tuesday, he said, and he wouldn't go back on his word. The leaders weren't sure if they had the votes to defeat the bill. Johnson couldn't even find out what the vote count was. "They don't know how many votes they have," he told Reedy in a tone of disbelief. Humphrey, of course, said he was sure they would have the votes, but Johnson, having had experience with Humphrey's counts in the past, had no confidence in them, and the lack of confidence proved justified. "They told me that the Mundt bill's pretty close," he was to say, "but when we checked it down, why they," the bill's supporters, "had a good many votes to spare." He had 3 days, the vote would be held Tuesday afternoon, to turn the vote around. And not only did the leaders not know what the count was, which senators had to be turned around, the man who might know, Larry O'Brien, had made it clear that at least for the moment, he didn't even want to discuss working for Lyndon Johnson. When Johnson tried to reach O'Brien that Saturday, he was told that he was tied up, and would remain tied up for the next couple of days, helping with preparations for the funeral. He had 4 days, until Wednesday at noon, before he would have to stand before a joint session of Congress and deliver his first speech as president. He would want to emphasize continuity in the speech, of course, to make clear that he was carrying on Kennedy's program, and he knew who he wanted to write it, Kennedy's speechwriter. He gave Ted Sorensen credit for the ringing phrases in Kennedy's speeches. Perhaps Sorensen could give his own some of that magic. At the conclusion of Saturday's cabinet meeting, he had walked over to Sorensen, sitting against the wall, and asked him to begin working on it. But Sorensen was still dazed by the grief and disbelief that had gripped him since he first heard the news. He was to say 45 years later that he had never been able to remember the details of that awful weekend. Unreal, unbelievable, a blur of pain and tears. That evening, Johnson tried again in the inner office in 274. "I do not recall much of that meeting," Sorensen was to say, "but I was blunt and unsmiling." Most of the meeting, Sorensen was to say, was devoted to his request that I stay. "I need you more than he needed you." But as best as he can recall, his response was, "I've given 11 years of my life to John Kennedy, and for those 11 years he was the only human being who mattered to me." Johnson may have intended to ask him again that evening to draft the joint session speech, but the request was not made. All the time, the calls kept pouring in. "Governor George Romney of Michigan is at the airport. An aide is asking if he, the governor, could talk to you if he came over," said a note Roberts handed him that Saturday. "Aide holding on 304, said another note a few minutes later. Picking up 304, Johnson said a few words to Romney, who might be his opponent in a few months. "Governor Lawrence would like to stop by at your convenience," said a note from Jenkins. "Harry Province is at the Washington Hotel, room 432, and is waiting." Suddenly, Jenkins was coming in to tell him that McCone was in the outer office. He motioned to Jenkins to show him right in. Entering, McCone closed the door behind him before he spoke. Oswald, the CIA had learned, had visited not only the Soviet embassy in Mexico City, but the Cuban embassy as well. There was even a call from Ralph Yarborough. When, after a while, Johnson hadn't returned it, the senator left a message with Jenkins. "The president will have my complete support in Texas and in the nation. If the president had lived another day, he would have seen some harmony in Texas." Returning the call after he received that message, Johnson said, "You're wonderful, and I'll be in touch with you. I appreciate it more than you know." "I have no ideological problem. I'm willing to give at least 90%, Yarborough said. "That's right. Always have," Lyndon Johnson interrupted. "Always have. I know that. Thank you, my friend." There was, Reedy was to say, one call after another, all day, from Hoover and Bundy. There were the things to do that no one had thought of, but that were essential. A presidential proclamation had to be issued to designate Monday, November 25th, the day of the funeral, as an official day of national mourning. After it had been written and approved, a memo that Reedy stuck in front of him told him that something had been left out. The proclamation authorized the closing of all government offices, but no one had thought of the banks. "Apparently, because of a legal quirk, we have not given the nation's banks authority to close Monday. A bank can be sued if it is not opened during regular hours, and the only way in which they are safe from such suits on Monday is if the day is proclaimed a legal holiday." By the time Saturday was over, Johnson had, since his confrontation with Robert Kennedy that morning, met with his cabinet as a group, and with three of its key members, Rusk, McNamara, and Labor Secretary Wirtz, individually, with Eisenhower and Truman, with leaders of Congress, with the CIA director, with Supreme Court Justice Goldberg, and over with his national security advisor, had gone to church, paid his respects to the dead president and to the dead president's widow in the White House, and had talked on the telephone with and one firmly to his side, perhaps another 40 people. Arriving in the office on Sunday with a list of problems that must be faced immediately, he was handed the instructions for his participation in the day's memorial ceremonies, which, he saw, would consume a substantial portion of the day. "The President and Mrs. Johnson will follow the casket through a cordon of honor troops from the East Room to the North Portico entrance, where the casket will be placed on the caisson. The president should place his right hand over his left breast while the casket is being placed on the caisson. The president and Mrs. Johnson will board vehicle number 1 for procession to the Capitol. At the conclusion of the last eulogy, the president will move from his position to the base of the catafalque, where the wreath-bearer will assist him in placing a wreath. And then he was told that also riding in vehicle number 1 would be the Attorney General. Just a few minutes later, as he was waiting in the East Room to step on the portico, an usher told him that Dean Rusk wanted to speak to him on the phone, and Rusk told him that Lee Harvey Oswald had just been shot on television. Shortly after the procession arrived at the Capitol, the assassin was pronounced dead, murdered by another assassin, and immediately the second murder, fostering as it did the impression that the assassination was part of a conspiracy, created a huge problem. Obviously, some sort of major investigation was necessary, but what type of an investigation, and by whom? One problem he dealt with that Sunday seemed somewhat less pressing than the others. After his return from the Capitol, faster coming back with motorcycle outriders clearing the way, no Kennedys in the car with him, there was a meeting in his office on Vietnam. Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge had returned from Saigon to report on the effects of the coup that had, 3 weeks previously, resulted in the assassinations of South Vietnamese President Ngo Dinh Diem and his brother, Secret Police Chief Ngo Dinh Nu, and the installation of a new government led by General Duong Van Big Minh. Most of America's major newspapers had welcomed the end of the repressive Diem regime, and there had been relatively few public statements about the coup from Capitol Hill. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Fulbright would soon be telling Johnson that he saw no need for any immediate action on his part. "I think we ought to give this new man a chance to see what he can do for a little while." And the meeting didn't make Johnson, who, Valenti recalls, had talked little of Vietnam that first night, feel the need for immediate action. Lodge, who had not been at all opposed to the coup, said that it had improved prospects for victory. None of the others sitting around the conference table in 274, Rusk, McNamara, Bundy, McCone, and Ball, agreed with this prediction. McCone, in fact, said that the new military leaders were having difficulty organizing a government, that Viet Cong activity seemed to have increased since the coup, and that he saw no reason for optimism. But there was no strong feeling from anyone but McCone that there had been substantial deterioration either, and Johnson was to recall that he found the net result modestly encouraging. A preliminary plan for covert operations against North Vietnam had been approved at a conference in Honolulu 2 days before Kennedy's assassination, and it was decided at the meeting in 274 that when the plan had been refined, it would be sent to the president for approval. The breathing space in foreign affairs appeared to include Vietnam. Of all the potential trouble spots in the world, Johnson would recall in his memoirs, "Only South Vietnam gave me real cause for concern. But compared with later periods, even the situation in Vietnam appeared to be relatively free from the pressure of immediate decisions." The solution seemed the same as in domestic matters: continuity, the continuation of Kennedy policies. Reinforcing that conclusion, furthermore, was a simple political calculation. As Bundy was to say, a presidential election was less than a year away, and major decisions on Vietnam in an election year were something no president would want to make. It was so under Johnson, and it would have been under Kennedy as well. Neither man wanted to go into the election as the one who either made war or lost Vietnam. If you could put it off, you did. With political calculations, Johnson was at ease. While the range, from Lodge to McCone, of the assessments of the Vietnam situation may have been mixed, Johnson's response wasn't. When, at the end of the discussion, Lodge told the president that unfortunately hard decisions would be necessary on Vietnam, Johnson barely hesitated, and his instructions to Lodge, Wicker was to write, were firm. There had been, the president said, too much bickering among the various American agencies in South Vietnam, the Army, the CIA, the USIA, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the State Department, over our aims there. We had spent too much of our time and energy trying to shape other countries in our own image. There would be time enough for broader objectives later, he said. At the moment, the main objective was to just win the war. He didn't want as much effort placed on so-called social concerns. He told Lodge to return to Vietnam and assure its new government that his administration would continue Kennedy's policy of helping Saigon to fight the communists. I am not going to lose Vietnam, he said. I'm not going to be the president who saw Southeast Asia go the way China went. Lodge raised a question about political support. I don't think Congress wants us to let the communists take over South Vietnam, Johnson said, noting that strong voices in Congress were urging the United States to take more forceful action in Vietnam. A tentative step in a different direction had recently been announced by the Kennedy administration. On October 2nd, McNamara and Taylor, returning from an inspection trip to Vietnam, had recommended stepping up the training of the Vietnamese Army so that American military personnel could be withdrawn from Vietnam, and had said that if this was done, it should be possible to withdraw the bulk of U.S. personnel by the end of 1965. Their report concluded that 1,000 Americans could be withdrawn by the end of 1963. We need a way to get out of Vietnam, and this is a way of doing it, McNamara said. At the close of Kennedy's meeting with his two envoys on October 2nd, Pierre Salinger had publicly announced that the president had endorsed their recommendations, saying that the president accepted their judgment that the major part of the U.S. military task can be completed by the end of 1965. They reported that by the end of this year, 1,000 military personnel can be withdrawn. The number of American personnel in Vietnam at the time was 16,732, and it was forecast that by the end of the year the number would be reduced to about 15,700. That had been before the coup. Whether Kennedy, despite the coup, would have kept the pledge to withdraw the 1,000 troops is unknown, but the pledge was on the public record. Johnson, calling in reporters after his meeting with Lodge and the others, reaffirmed, the New York Times said, the policy objectives of his predecessor regarding South Vietnam. The Washington Post reported that after the meeting, White House sources said the late President Kennedy's statement about the troop withdrawals before the end of the year remains in force. Johnson's statement said, first, the central point of United States policy on South Vietnam remains, namely to assist the new government there in winning the war against the communist Viet Cong insurgents. The adoption of all measures shall be determined by their potential contribution to this overriding objective. Second, the White House statement of October 2nd on the withdrawal of United States troops from South Vietnam remains in force. This statement said the program for training of Vietnamese troops should have progressed by the end of this year to the point where 1,000 United States military personnel can be withdrawn. 2 days later, on November 26th, the reaffirmation, all the conflicting parts of it, was given official status. On November 21st, the day before Kennedy's death, Bundy had drafted a National Security Action Memorandum, a formal notification to the heads of government agencies of a presidential decision, and directives to take steps required to implement it. On November 26th, Johnson approved the memorandum, NSAM 273. It emphasized that the Vietnam conflict was a war against communism, and a war that had to be won, and that it remains the central objective of the United States in South Vietnam to assist the people and government of that country to win it. The specific withdrawal goals enunciated under Kennedy, 1,000 by the end of 1963, the bulk of the rest by the end of 1965, remained as stated, the NSAM declared. Among the directives included in the document, however, was one for the planning of possible increased military activity, a reference to the plan for covert military operations against North Vietnam, SINCPAC Operations Plan 34A-64, or Op Plan 34A, that had been discussed and approved at the November 20th Honolulu conference. If Vietnam seemed, no matter how misleading the impression, relatively free from the pressure of immediate decisions, without deadlines by which specific actions had to be taken, little else was. All during those 3 days, days filled with people, days filled with telephone calls, in Juanita Roberts's recollection, The crisis never stopped. She, Marie Famer, Cliff Carter, and Mildred Stiegel would funnel the more important calls to the desk at which Walter Jenkins sat, taking notes on his legal pads, quiet, outwardly calm, the only sign of tension the steady reddening of his face as the day went on. A light on one of the buttons on the telephone console on Jenkins's desk showed when Johnson, in his private office, was talking on that line. Except when Johnson was talking to someone in person in his office, one of the buttons was almost always lit. When for a moment Johnson was alone in his office and the buttons were suddenly all dark, Jenkins would seize the opportunity, snatching up his pads and going in, to read Johnson the messages that required immediate attention. The buzzer from the inner office would sound on their desks. Johnson would tell them to set up an appointment with someone or to get someone else on the phone. Sometimes he would buzz out and say, "What have you got?" And we'd tell him, Colonel Roberts says. Sometimes he would come out into the two rooms with the desks crammed together and the phones ringing and people hurrying in and out. And, Roberts says, if he'd pass our desks and we had something we thought he should see, we'd give it to him. There was so much to do. He was working as rapidly as he possibly could, she recounts. And, of course, she says, he was constantly having to leave for the ceremonies for his predecessor. But, as had been the case Friday night, there was, during those next days in EOB 274, very little conversation. No lost motion. It wasn't necessary for us to talk. To Marie Famer, her boss was a changed man, transformed. At first, she couldn't understand why he looked so different from the Lyndon Johnson for whom she had been working. But she came to realize, she says, that the very movements of his body were different. That instead of the awkward, almost lunging strides and flailing movements of his arms that had previously often characterized Johnson under tension, now his stride was shorter, measured, and his arms were staying by his sides, hardly moving at all. That there was no flailing, that only his head moved. It wasn't just that there was no flailing emotionally, there was no flailing physically either. It was as if he was actively controlling his body. Not only his movements, but his voice was transformed, she says. It had none of the impatience in it that was often, usually, present, none of the anger and rage into which impatience so often morphed, none of any of the emotions with which it was generally filled. His voice was not low so much as it was level. It didn't fluctuate in tone. He was keeping it under control, calm. It was an iron control, a discipline that, during those 3 days, never slipped. I've never seen him as controlled, as self-disciplined, as careful, and as moderate as he's been this week, Bill Moyers told Times' Loy Miller. He's remained calmer. He's been more careful to sort out and reason his feelings and his thoughts, and he's been good to work with. You know very well how he used to thrash around and blow his top so often. It seemed like he had a clock inside him with an alarm that told him at least once an hour that it was time to go chew somebody out. But he hasn't lost his temper once since 2 p.m. last Friday. It is remarkable, really, Miller reported to Times editors in New York. Some of us who have seen Lyndon at his most cantankerous in times of lesser stress were wondering what sort of tantrums he must be having behind the office doors as the immense pressures of his new job and necessity for seizing it quickly bore down on him. But my every inquiry brings the reply that there were no tantrums, none of the cursing, none of the glass-throwing, none of the vicious rages. And the replies Miller received were accurate. There was never a crack in the calmness, the aura of command, the sense of purpose. The few reporters who were allowed to spend time in 274 during those days saw it for themselves, and those of them who had known Johnson for years were startled by what they saw now. Hurrying from 274 to Times offices to describe Johnson in a wire to New York, John Steele used adjectives like direct, calm, deliberate, and nouns like composure and sense of being collected. Hugh Seide felt he was showing more of such qualities than he had ever demonstrated before. There were questions, decisions to be made, just flooding in on him one after the other, he says. He just handled them one after the other, without a pause. Business in 274 seems to be progressing matter-of-factly, another reporter wrote, and actually quite well compared to the tumultuous office atmosphere which has often surrounded Johnson in the past. Conferring with Johnson on Saturday, Abe Fortas was struck by his studied calm. Studied. Other aides also felt the calm was a mask, and they had reason to feel that way. On Saturday night, after a 12-hour working day, Johnson was having dinner at the Elms with Busby and Thornberry. At dinner, he was rather quiet, in a mood Busby recognized. He was thinking things through, he says. Very intense. You could smell wood burning. Going upstairs after dinner, he asked Busby to sit in his bedroom until he had fallen asleep, and after the lights had been turned out, Busby did that, until after about a half hour of silence, he thought it was safe to leave and started tiptoeing toward the door. "Buzz," said Lyndon Johnson's voice out of the darkness. "Buzz, is that you?" And when Buzz said that it was, the voice said, "Buzz, I'm not asleep yet." Returning to his chair, Buzz waited for a while longer, but again when he tried to leave, Johnson asked, "Buzz, are you still there?" Busby assured him he was, and that he had just been walking over to the window to adjust a curtain. It took several more attempts and several more "Buzz, are you still there's?" before he finally made it out of the room. Busby, who loved him, didn't mind waiting, he was to say. He had done it before, when Lyndon Johnson found it hard to get to sleep. "Anything I could do to gentle him down," he says. His mind just wouldn't stop working, working, working. Although during those 3 days he didn't have the use of the White House or adequate space for his staff, while the Oval Office and its adjoining rooms stood empty across the narrow street, he had the telephone, and he used it, as only Lyndon Johnson could use it. "I knew I had to secure the cooperation of the natural leaders of the nation," he was to say, and it was over the telephone that he did it. For the sake of the country, he wanted unity behind his presidency, and for the sake of his political future, the 1964 election and the convention and the string of primaries and deadlines that loomed so imminently, he wanted it within his party, wanted to forestall any liberal attempt to contest his nomination, and wanted it fast. The leaders who would, in addition to the Kennedy faction, of course, be most reluctant to support him, were the leaders who had opposed him so violently when he ran for the presidency in 1960. The liberal leaders of the great labor unions and the major civil rights organizations, the leaders who had opposed him even for the vice presidency, and who had called the nomination a double cross and threatened to stage a floor fight, even to name a rival candidate against him. Although the hostility of some of these men had softened during his vice presidency, some of them regarded themselves as his friends now, he couldn't feel confident of their support, particularly if, in 1964, a rival candidate for the nomination was supported by the Kennedy faction, or was, in fact, named Kennedy. The hostility of many of them, perhaps most of them, had not softened at all. Despite the St. Augustine tables and the Gettysburg speech, they still felt that at heart he was a Texas conservative, still felt that, whatever he might have been saying for the last 3 years, Lyndon Johnson was still, in reality, what he had, in their opinion, always been, anti-union, and not enthusiastic about civil rights, not a liberal at all. And among the union leaders whose hostility had not softened was the most powerful of them, the man Lyndon Johnson called labor's stud duck, because other union chiefs followed his lead, the man who in 1960, calling him the arch foe of labor, had staged a vendetta against him, a vendetta in which, during the intervening 3 years, he had called no truce. In dealing with these men now, however, Johnson possessed advantages he had never had before, not only the power of the presidency, but what the presidency symbolized, and the desire evoked by that symbol of Americans to support their president, a president who had taken office at such a difficult moment. The first call Lyndon Johnson made when he arrived in EOB 274 on Saturday morning demonstrated how much that might mean. "George," Lyndon Johnson began. "Mr. President," George Meany replied. "George," Lyndon Johnson said, "you know how tragic this whole thing is. and I just called to tell you that you have been of inestimable help to this administration and to your country, and I need you as we've never needed you before." "I'm still in a state of shock," Meany said, "but if the president needed him, he would be there. I can tell you we'll go down the line with you, and you have got an awful job, but I'm sure you can do it." Johnson went on telling him how much he needed him. "I know I'm totally inadequate to it, but maybe with friends like you, and the phone's always there, and you just let me know and come over." He said it was time for enemies to unite. "Let's try to pull our country, close ranks, and pull it out of this terrible situation in which we find ourselves." Meany tried to encourage him. "It's a tough job, but I'm sure you can do it," he said. "I think you, with your training and everything else, Mr. President, you can do it. And you'll have me and all of our gang back of you 1,000%. "I want your counsel and I want your friendship," Lyndon Johnson said. "Well, you have it," Meany replied. By our gang, Meany meant labor leaders like Reuther of the auto workers, McDonald of the steel workers, Rose and Dubinsky of the garment workers. Despite Meany's assurance that Johnson would have them behind him, Johnson telephoned each of them himself, assuring them that, as he said to Reuther, he would be loyal to the Kennedy program, the liberal program, that he wouldn't abandon the ship, that "we're going to turn our sails into the wind and we're going places and we're going to carry on," telling McDonald, "I want to meet the needs of our people and there are many unfulfilled ones." So he would ask Congress to do more good and less economizing. "We'll just have to go after them and we'll need you then. You better stand ready and be armed." He had the key line pretty well down now. When Reuther said, "Mr. President, you have my prayers and my friendship and every possible help that I can offer," Johnson said, "Well, I need it all. I never needed it as much in my life." And the line worked. "Any time that you need me, you call and I'll be there," Reuther said. Arthur Goldberg, now a Supreme Court justice, but once as general counsel to the steelworkers at the heart of labor's hierarchy, had telephoned Reedy that morning and advised him that, as Johnson was to put it, Meany liked the visible signs of consultation, public acknowledgement of his importance, and wanted also acknowledgement that he was labor's leader. Reedy had typed up this advice and handed it to Johnson. The call to Meany, Reedy's memo said, should be told to the press. The calls to Reuther, Rose, and the others should remain off the record, so that Meany would believe he had been the only leader called. Johnson told Reedy to make sure reporters knew he had telephoned Meany, and to make sure reporters didn't find out he had telephoned the others. Then he turned to leaders of the civil rights movement. He told them his problems. "It's just an impossible period," he said to Martin Luther King, Jr. "We got a budget coming up that's, we got nothing to do with it, it's practically already made. And we got a civil rights bill that hadn't even passed the House, and it's November, and Hubert Humphrey told me yesterday everybody wanted to go home. We got a tax bill that they haven't touched." He went to considerable trouble for them, graciously, warmly, when at the end of his conversation with Johnson Sunday evening, Whitney Young of the National Urban League mentioned that he had sort of expected tickets for himself and his family to the Kennedy funeral services, but hadn't received them. Johnson said Bobby, not he, was handling the funeral arrangements, but "let me inquire on it," and added, "I'm taking my family, and I'd almost take you as my guest if I can get an extra ticket." He said he would get back to Young Monday morning, but then apparently realized that might be too late, arranged for the tickets with Sergeant Shriver, and called Young back to tell him he had done so, and to tell him that if there was any problem with the tickets, he should call Moyers at once. "God bless you," Young said. He made them laugh, using a Texas axiom to assure Young he wouldn't stop fighting for civil rights. "We'll keep coming," he said. Kind of like the fellow who said, "What's the difference between a Texas Ranger and a Texas Sheriff?" Well, when you hit a Ranger, he just keeps coming. Solemn though the day may have been, Young burst into laughter. He told them they could depend on him. When Dr. King mentioned Kennedy's great progressive policies that he sought to initiate, Johnson said, Well, I'm going to support them all, and you can count on that. He told them that he needed their support. I'll have to have you all's help, and I never needed it more than I do now, he said. And they told him he would have it. Just feel free to call on us for anything, Dr. King said. One of the most difficult problems that had faced Johnson when he was thrust into the presidency was the dislike and suspicion with which he was regarded by not a few leaders of the labor and the civil rights movements, whose support was indispensable to him if he wanted to unite the Democratic Party and if he wanted to secure its presidency.